Hello, everyone who's joining us on Facebook or here in Zoom. And we're having an amazing, amazing conversation today. We are joined by the amazing Kim Pasi Yosef from Tel Aviv. And soon we will introduce Ina as well, who's a very, very dear friend. Ina Rodolf, did I say your last name right?
Yes, very, even with a German accent.
I spent enough time in Germany to learn how to fake it. But we are joined by Ina, who I've met about 8 years ago and stayed friends since then. We're going to talk about Iraq, which is where she's been doing her research, where she's doing her PhD, focusing on Iraq and specific topics in Iraq. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But I'm excited because Iraq is a topic that comes in the news, used to come in the news a lot. And I feel like despite talking about Iraq so much, I would meet people and start talking about simple things. And then it looks like despite the crazy amount in news, basics about the country has never been explored. Simple things about like even Iraq being one of the really maybe the main cradle of civilizations that we know. Mesopotamia is literally Iraq, but even the diversity, the people who live there, the political complications there, there's so much that's happening in that place. And we kind of mainly because of the war that happened there only learned about Iraq and Saddam Hussein and this and that, and didn't really get to know a little bit more of these realities and complications. So today we can touch on that, right, Kim?
Right, and it's another episode about a place that Aziz and I haven't visited yet. So we're eager to learn more. And from our earlier conversation with Ina, we actually found out that there is a Jewish community still there in Iraq. Let's go to Ina. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and how did you even get to Iraq?
Thank you very much for the invitation. As Aziz mentioned, I can't even believe that it has been 8 years since we first met in Tunisia, and it was in the midst of, you know, the whole Arab Spring, youth movements, reforms. I remember I was working, researching a piece on the Nahda party, and we ended up talking about my time in Palestine. So a bit about myself, as Aziz implied in the beginning, I've been blessed with a rather vagabond childhood. So I come from Bulgaria, from Eastern Europe, and while my mom was pregnant, she and my dad were residing in Yemen, in south of Yemen. My dad was ambassador in the Great People's Democratic Republic. So my mom went to give birth to Sofia and then a couple of months returned to Aden with me. So I managed to witness like the last days before the collapse of communism, the last days of the Yemeni Socialist Party. And after that, when I was a teenager, the path led me again to Yemen. So my dad and I returned there in 1999. And I remember it vividly because it was shortly after the late Ali Abdullah Saleh had won the elections with percentage of 96. Which I think Donald Trump would definitely like envy that, because like there would be no room for recount.
Well, all Arab leaders win elections with 95%+, all of them. It's incredible. We all love our leaders so much in the Middle East.
So when you ask me how did you end up studying like tactics of popular mobilization in the Middle East, I guess like it has something to do like with this date. But to come back to Iraq, as Aziz said, I ended up indeed in the security studies realm. I'm finishing, inshallah, my PhD at King's College London and the War Studies Department, focusing on militarism and paramilitary organizations in Iraq specifically. But from my profile, I come from a very classical background. So I studied in Germany, I studied Islamic studies, which is like very much focused on theology, on history, where I was also confronted for the first time with classical Arabic grammar. And there I had this amazing professor, Endowitz, to whom I'm still very grateful. So she introduced to us like this whole realm of Islamic rationalism or Islamic rationalist thought. And I ended up specializing for, I think around a year, I did mainly research on the Mu'tazila movement, which is an Islamic rationalist movement that flourished in Basra and in Baghdad from the 8th to the 10th century. And for the Arabic speakers, it's very interesting also linguistically speaking, a very interesting term, because Mu'tazila came actually from the verb i'tazala. So it means like for someone to break up from a movement or like from a conventional circle of thought. And this is what happened with one of the founders of the movement, with Vasil ibn Atta. And it was a very modern discussion about the status of the person who has sinned. So according to the Mu'tazilites, he was to remain in a state in between. So in Arabic, they called it manzila bayna manzilatayn. So it was a very interesting theological discussion that sparked my interest. I come myself like from a sort of a Sufi family, because my dad was Orthodox, my mom was Catholic, and we already like had like these sectarian tensions in the family. And very interesting discussions about how to work and read religious texts. And that's why I was very much attracted like by this Iraqi school of thought that first rejected the whole doctrine of Quran being something that has never been created, but they regarded it as the word of God, which is to be interpreted rationally. And even now, like, I don't want to sound like a classical Orientalist. If I think about problems and conspiracy theories that we have in the West, I think maybe such a movement of rationalizing Western religious texts would be a welcome phenomenon in the current times.
already the opening kind of, I have a million questions on some of the stuff you mentioned. So you wanted, I mean, the topic you chose is a really complicated topic to study. You talking about studying in a war zone, you know, Iraq isn't the safest place, a place that is really complicated. You're talking about militia groups. And when you talk about Iraq, there are so many different militia groups. How is it for a woman to decide to go do that in, you know, were you worried about safety? How would you even approach groups? I can imagine this, you know, Bulgarian woman coming to Iraq and being, hey, I wanna, like, you're gonna have to meet with militias, with religious groups who might not be so fond of meeting with you. How did you go around doing all of this?
I think like this gender predicament has been a bit overexploited, like in the media, in terms of, oh my God, like you are a woman, how would you be accepted? How would they treat you? I must say, like, as long as you have done your homework and kind of like bring a bit of a cultural sensitivity, like to the context in which you're operating, then conducting this research as a female analyst has had its own benefits, because I have always like felt protected, but I also like never felt the urge to engage in, let's say, ill-timed provocations, like just for the sake of making a point, where I'm wearing the abaya. And in some contexts, in some cities, like if you really want to mingle, if you don't want to stand out, if it's really about your interest in the cultural, historical, archaeological sites, then you adopt a certain clothing and you adopt a certain code of conduct. And I think if we are able like to adjust our behavior in a normal setting, like in our daily life, then it should be even like more important to do so when you are a guest and when you are the one who depends on people to open up, to provide information and just like to engage with you in a conversation. That's why, like, for me, being a woman, even like having conducted the whole pilgrimage, there has been a very special experience. I was never too pushy. Like, there were certain contexts where I knew, okay, like, here, now is the time, like, where I will be sitting with the women. And if you free yourselves of like this Western paradigms, okay, like this is a sign of discrimination, but like take it as an opportunity, you can have like very interesting discussions like on both sides. And I can only encourage women to undertake this such a research, in case they are, of course, familiar with the topic, familiar with the context, and willing to adjust, like willing a bit like to play like with the sort of like barriers that are before one.
Yeah, the last point I think is crucial. You need to know what you're coming towards. You need to know the culture. You need to know the conflict, like in order to know how to play into the game. I just want to take you, I want to take us back a bit to give our listeners some background. I mean, Iraq seems quite complicated. Can you explain who are the major political or militia groups that we're looking at?
So in my dissertation, I am looking into the institutionalization of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, which in Arabic means popular mobilization or the popular mobilization units. Now, I just want to point out that I do not frame or define them as a militia movement, because legally speaking, the Hashd al-Sha'bi is a state-sanctioned security agency. They're legalized by a law. But because they were one of the most prominent forces that fought against ISIS in this initial stages of the campaign, they comprise a lot of like pre-existing armed factions that were engaged in armed resistance, both against the regime of Saddam Hussein, but also like during the periods of sectarian violence after the US invasion. So to explain this in more simple terms, it's about the evolving relationship between the Iraqi state and this paramilitary state-recognized umbrella, which at the beginning was used as an auxiliary force because the Iraqi army had collapsed, confronted with the Mosul invasion. And the Iraqi armed forces were suffering from a huge leadership vacuum, which led to the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani to pronounce his famous fatwa and sort of like to appeal all Iraqi citizens to join and boost the capacities of Iraqi security forces. And that sort of like created the momentum for the creation of this quite interesting and quite diverse institution.
Is it mainly, because you said Sistani, and just for people who don't know, Sistani is the main Shia religious figure in Iraq. Is it a Shia group, or does it have Sunnis in it?
That's a very interesting question. And I did specifically research about Sunni tribal formations that participated within the popular mobilization. The Sunni units are more commonly referred to as Hashd al-Ash'ari, like the tribal Hashd. But even though, as you rightly pointed out, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is the most prominent Shiite reference, like for the Shiite Muslim world, but still he's respected by all segments of Iraqi society. And politicians listen to his sermons, and he has often been referred or regarded as the moral compass of the country. So when he issued the fatwa, it was not directed at the Shiite population of Iraq. On the contrary, the fatwa had a very distinct language. It avoided all sorts of discriminatory Shiite-specific references. And it was a very clear patriotic appeal addressed at all Iraqi citizens to join the security forces. But as I mentioned in the beginning, as there had been a total collapse of the formal chain of commands, this created like a window of opportunity for pre-existing armed formations like to step in, to sort of help out, as here I'm quoting their own narrative, and to take charge of the administrative process, managing the overflow of volunteers that responded to al-Sistani's fatwa. And after the creation in 2014, currently we have an institutionalized structure that has its own law, and that's being referred by the Iraqi prime minister, and even by the current Iraqi prime minister, as one of the pillar of the national defense infrastructure. So this mobility and the agility, I think, demonstrates a lot how the notion of Iraqi statehood and like what Iraqi statehood stands for very much determines or shapes the institutional part of such commonly referred to as hybrid armed actors and how they fit into like this national scheme of things.
Can you briefly maybe explain to us, because this is a question I get all the time, but the three major powers in Iraq are Shia, Sunnis, or divides, let's say, Shia, Sunnis, and Kurds, right? And there are smaller other groups obviously there, but these are the three major. Can you a little bit touch on that and explain what are the major differences, what each really side is trying to gain out of this? Is there a way really, like you said, Sistani gets respect from everyone, but is there really a way for the Iraqi state to again be an Iraqi state, not a Shia, Sunni, Kurdish, where everybody's kind of pulling for their own side, creating a three-state solution instead of one country?
Yeah, I mean, like such formulations or vague suggestions of having three largely autonomous regions are what, to a lot extent, a lot of Iraqis associate with President-elect Joe Biden. Because of a very historic op-ed that he had published. But I would like to emphasize something else, like these divisions, they are not of a sectarian nature, even though, as you pointed out, like we have this quota system where the spoils of the political process are being equally divided between elite representatives of all of these like three major forces. But what we have witnessed today also with the civil protests is that these Kurdish, Sunni, Shiite, and even like minority representative elites, like are so much entrenched within the political system, like they know the limitations of the game, like they know what's at stake, and they can work with each other perfectly as long as it is about and it remains about sustaining the status quo and preserving the same type of transactional politics that actually brought the people back to the streets last October. So the major divide right now is more between those elite forces and the people who are currently on the street. And as maybe we had seen back then in Tunisia, what had started as a protest about social services, you know, improving quality of life, demonstrating against corruption, in Iraq took another magnitude, another level. So what the young people on the streets, and like not just young, but what I have personally witnessed on the squares is something that bridges the generational divide. And what they want now is not just livelihoods, but one of their main slogans was Nurid al-Watan, like they want statehood, they want a state, and they want to govern a system that is no longer based on quotas and elite bargaining, but on the notion of citizenry. And I think like that's a very important distinction. And any Western diplomat or politician who would be assigned with the Iraq portfolio like has to understand that the biggest challenge would not be to mediate like between those three different forces or currents, but to help decision makers to understand the language of the street and moreover to act on it and not just, let's say, adopt it cosmetically during parliamentary discussions. I hope I haven't gone too much into detail.
No, that was amazing, because I don't think, sadly, most people haven't heard about those protests that happened in Iraq, even though they were bigger than any probably other protests happening in the Middle East. But Kim.
Yeah, I mean, already it's, which is shocking, and it's, but I'm completely aware that I inhabit my own information and like feedback bubble. But for people who have been working like extensively on the region, Levant, it was shocking to see that there in January the death toll was beyond 600, not to mention like people who have been injured, and we still have very intransparent attacks on social activists. A prominent, one of the most excellent Iraqi security researchers was also assassinated, and this is one of the major challenges for the current government, like to restore the state's monopoly on violence and more to convince Iraqi citizens who are very much disillusioned that the state has the capability to enforce a monopoly on violence and to put the perpetrators to justice.
You asked if you're going in too deep, and I wanted to say that I want to take you in deeper. I'm thinking of our listeners that sometimes they say, like, let's start from the beginning. Let's understand, you know, what's going on the streets today. Are these groups, you know, like even the most simple of information? Are they living together? Would you say that there are cultural differences still? Would you say that it's not something that you would even feel about someone? Like when you meet someone, would you know what group they are from? I guess all of these questions to kind of simplify what is going on the ground. And then the question after that is, where is Iraq going from here, to connect to what you were saying before?
So my personal impression from, let's say, like from the last 3 years was that this sectarian differences, especially like between people of our generation, matter less and less. And this was very much also demonstrated during the last parliamentary elections, not regarding like the results that we had, but more in terms of the political discourse. So we saw that even traditional parties from the Shiite powerhouse tried to focus their a manifesto or electoral program on issues rather than on sect-coded mobilization. We have also witnessed some interesting alliances or, let's say, strange allies coming together. For example, the Iraqi Communist Party found a common ground around the issue of governance with the movement of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. And they had a coalition called Sa'irun, Marching Forward, which to a large extent like based its whole narrative on improving governance, on enhancing accountability standards and delivering services, especially like in the more neglected southern regions. So I think like this is one of the nuances that I would like to magnify for our listeners. Also during the protests, there was like a vocal rejection of sectarianized attempts to analyze or to portray the demonstrations. They all said, like, I may be from a Sunni background, I may be from a Shia background, I may be Kurdish. Regardless of that, like, we all want the same thing. And at the end, like, our confessional belonging is something that is private. To quote from one of the interviews that I had with a prominent member of the Politburo of the Iraqi Communist Party, when I was asking about like how they were working together with the Sadrist movement. And he said the following. He said, when speaking about Sa'id Muqtada al-Sadr, he said that he's unlikely to convert him into a strong believer. And also, like, he himself isn't likely to convert the cleric into a Marxist. But both sides have reached this insight that currently what you have to undertake are governance reforms. And what one believes in private has nothing to do whether you have access to electricity, to education, and as we have also seen during the corona pandemic, to decent healthcare.
For those, actually, I don't know, Kim, even how much you were involved in this. We actually, just before ISIS took over Mosul, we used to run tours in Kurdistan. Mejdi ran a few tours, not many, because the demand in Kurdistan wasn't as high as we would have wanted it to be. And we actually were supposed to have a tour in Kurdistan a few weeks after when ISIS took over. So it's a crazy thing. Maybe I'll start taking a couple of questions from what people are sending a lot.
This one points about Kurdistan, and I would be very interesting like to hear your perspective, because what I saw in Kurdistan or like in the Iraqi Kurdish region was the same phenomenon. Like you had older elites, like generations caught in this competition or rivalry between the KDP and the PUK. And then you had like a lot of young people who were more interested in like the best access to funds in seed funding, who are like very entrepreneurial from their thinking and to whom these divisions were sort of like old fashioned and not really relevant like for their daily life. Mm-hmm. For their personal ambitions, like to fulfill their career path, for example.
Absolutely, I think that's definitely the groups we've sent to there. It just fell in love with it, and they definitely wanted to go to Baghdad and to Basra. Didn't feel safe enough. We didn't feel it was safe enough then to send them to those places. But they fell in love with it. And one of the things everyone who went reported was they were shocked by how developed Kurdistan was. Erbil was like, you couldn't believe you in a city that had a war just a few years earlier. And that was incredible to hear. They're like, it's like a booming city and there's construction everywhere and big companies are coming there and people are, like you said, innovating and everybody wants to work in high tech. And it's like, where am I? This is not the Iraq I hear about in the news. So that was interesting.
And that's super unfortunate because apart like from my peers who also like work in a similar context, I have been confronted with so many relevant questions, like as if I am literally entering a total war zone. And unfortunately, in terms of imagery, I think a lot of people still have this idea or notion of Iraq from CNN caterers, like maybe from the US invasion or like also from the rise of the Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State. And whenever I had like time for private conversations there or to see my friends in Baghdad, I have also witness a normal environment, like where the conversations, the issues that youth cares about are very similar to those in Berlin. So you have co-working spaces, you have them like discussing the latest type of innovations, but of course, like you have much more of built up frustration because of the continuous governance failures by subsequent administrations.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask my question then. Well, Dave here asked us about when ISIS destroyed historical and archaeological sites and identity like Hatra, what have been the cultural destruction that is also evident? And maybe I'll take it a bit more. If through the last 20 years, and even during Saddam Hussein's era, a lot of certain cultural sites, depends on who's in charge, has been destroyed. ISIS destroyed some, Saddam destroyed some for the Kurds or for Shia, you know, everyone seemed to destroy. How is that affecting on the identity of people there? How is that affecting the reality of life, of who you are as an Iraqi versus, like we've been talking about, versus your religious or ethnic identity?
So that is an extremely like dangerous arena, especially when you have had investigations like pointing to a certain group. And let's say if the cultural heritage has been a holy site, like for the Shia population, and the perpetrator has been from a certain Sunni group, often such instances or like episodes have been taken advantage of and have led to an increase of sect-coded violence. So I think like the problem like with destruction of this cultural sites, like heritage, particularly is also like how it is being addressed like by politicians. I think you have to be, and also by the media, you have to be like very careful, like when you point the finger at someone, like not to stigmatize the whole group. Because like in a context like Iraq and Aziz, like you've worked like in a lot of conflict areas, like with identity rivalries, you know how easy it is then to victimize the whole group, like often at the cost of innocent civilians. And that's why I love the work of Mejditors, because like this is what you guys like have been working towards, like to stop like these stigmatizations that we have seen in Iraq, but like it's also not a single case, like where you have had victimhoods and sort of like scapegoating of a whole like social set of actors.
Thanks. I'll continue with the questions that we have here. Before the Gulf War, the role and place of women in Iraq were fairly progressive. What is true today?
It depends in which sphere are we talking about. I have experienced Iraqi women as extremely active at the forefront, especially like during the last wave of protests. I have interviewed a lot of Iraqi women that were like engaged in social, in cultural movements. But as in some other places in the region, they don't have like the front seat, especially if you look at parliamentary committees. And I think this is more of a maybe a regional problem, that we all remember these quite sarcastic pictures of this all male panel that was supposed like to discuss women empowerment. And that's a phenomenon where a lot of Iraqi women are pushing against, but they still have a very limited framework, like where they can push for reforms. And sadly to say, assassination against women continue to be part of daily life. And they're most easily intimidated, like most easily being pressured, especially if you're a woman and you are defending some, let's say, uncomfortable positions. It's very easy, like, to start with your reputation, to tarnish your reputation, to tarnish your honor, to involve the family. And once again, like, even for Western organizations working with working in the field of gender equality or women empowerment, you have to understand the stakes, and you have to understand like also how costly it is for such female activists like to have like their whole families dragged into this process, regardless if they happen to share their views or not.
Yeah, activism is tough for everyone. It's a lot tougher for women, a lot tougher for women in certain places. I encountered the same in Afghanistan, where some women were doing incredible work, but then it took 10 times being more bold than the men who were doing that work. But let's move to a different maybe direction, if everyone's cool with that. Here's a fact that would surprise people. The biggest pilgrimage anywhere in the world, isn't in Mecca, is actually in Iraq, where millions of people, even in the midst of the conflict, even in the worst times, millions of people would go to Iraq every year to one couple of cities you mentioned earlier, to Karbala, to Najaf, would go every year there for their pilgrimage. Can you tell us about that pilgrimage? And we get some of your photos from that pilgrimage. You've been there. that's like when we talk about tourism, I mean, this fits into, you know, pilgrimage kind of tourism that we not aware of pretty much.
So I'm glad you asked me about that, because it has been one of my most vivid memories from Iraq. I traveled alone. I didn't have a team. I didn't have a cameraman or a fixer. I literally arrived with my visa at the airport, and I was extremely positively surprised by the administration and by the reception of people from different countries. Of course, I have to admit that when I did this last year, because of the political situation, you had a limited amount of foreign observers, participants, etc. But the moment people knew in a private conversation that you are not, let's say, a Shia pilgrim doing the Arba'in visit, they were very respectful and they wanted to learn what has led me to participate, what has been my personal interest. So we walked from Najaf to Karbala. It was an unforgettable experience, and along the way, you can witness anything possible, and everything is being offered for you. You had this malkip or tents where people could stay for the night. You had the different soup kitchens with a lot of volunteers in insane amounts of delicious food along the way. I do not want to imagine how this could have looked like in the midst of a pandemic, such an experience. And when I arrived in Karbala, it was such an overwhelming sight, because you are there with a lot of people that are experiencing deep spiritual religious devotion emotions, and as I mentioned, I have huge respect for religion and for every individual. I think with a sense of empathy, you can not remain numb to what you're confronted to there. There were different events, discussions organized where you could learn about the trauma. People really cry and they relieve the battle of Karbala. Maybe I should say something about that. Mm-hmm. So Arba'in in Arabic means 40, and it's the commemoration of the 40 days of mourning after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who was killed with his 71 companions in the battle of Karbala. And that's why it's this holy site. And when
he's the grandson of Prophet Muhammad.
The grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, exactly. And when people recount the events of what had happened in Karbala, they really start crying, and they relive the whole episodes. And for me, the most interesting moment, because we also speak of tourism, I ended up in a meeting in a group of representatives of mothers who have lost their sons in the massacre of Srebrenica. They were not Shia, but they said that even being Sunna, they love the Ahlul al-Bayt, the Prophet's family. And they were received by the representative of the Grand Ayatollah, Ahmad al-Safi. And it was, the whole discussion was about the importance of forgiveness and of moving on. So for them, reliving with their Shia brothers, the whole trauma of Karbala, was to an extent reliving and coming to terms with their own personal trauma of having lost their loved ones in Srebrenica. And it was an extremely emotional, a very candid moment, like where there were no masks, there was like no specific rhetoric for a media. There was no media even like in the room, but you saw like this eye level empathic dialogue of like people meeting at the level of humanity. And this was an extremely humbling experience. So it gave me a lot of ideas like how many unresolved ethnic, religious conflicts we have also witnessed in Europe and also in Eastern Europe particularly, and how many similarities are there, and also like need for all of these communities who have gone through something similar to talk, to converse, like to find ways of reconciling yourself, like with even representatives of people from the rival camp. And things like that are already happening in Iraq. So for example, I also witnessed a very interesting initiative from certain like Shiite clerics who started dialogue with representatives of universities in Sunni majority areas where ISIS had its foothold. And it shows like that Iraq is on a people's level. They are searching for this dialogue. They have seen enough of catastrophe, of polarization, of sect-coded violence. They are aware of this trap, and they are currently actively confronting this jeopardized or like this very risky situation.
Are they also seeking the conversation with the Middle East in general, and not only the conversation within, like to create some sort of cooperation with the wider Arab world?
Yes, I mean, very much so. And about every individual country, like we can speak for hours. There is a scholarly debate. So for example, during the spring, for the birthday of Imam Hussein, there are also festivities where representatives, let's say like from the Zaytuna University, come there and get to participate in a theological discussion. So at the clerical level, I have seen a lot of like this intellectual debates, people from Egypt, from Al-Azhar, from Tunisia. There have been also a lot of cooperations with Kuwait.
Can I push it a bit different?
Yeah.
Do you feel, I mean, when I think of Iraq, I think an Arab country. But Iraq has a strong association to also Iran, for example, because of the Shia community. Do you think people there identify more with the Arab world or more with Iran or more with maybe somebody else? I don't know. Or is this like a complex thing that they identify with both? I'm not sure, because majority of Iraqis are actually Shia, not Sunni. And so yeah. I really find it hard for me to know where does this identity in relation to the Arab world versus Iran fit?
It's still like a very controversial discussion, and it has been exacerbated a lot like by, let's say, populist media, because whenever something happens in Iraq, like there is this urge to make it about a conflict between the US and Iran or Saudi Arabia and Iran. And you ask me like with what people identify on the ground, like they want to identify with Iraq. Like they want to identify like with an Iraqi state, but their problem currently or their main concern is like that what they have is like this love for Iraq and like this absence of a state. So one of the slogans during the protests, like even from within Shia communities, was not particularly flattering to Iran, but also like not necessarily to the US. So they said like, we don't want Iran, we don't want US, like we want Iraqi interest like to come first. And even though I know like that in an American environment, it has a different connotation, but in the Iraqi context was actually like something positive. It was like this growing awareness. We don't want to be a battlefield like for the next geopolitical confrontation, like being between our neighbors, or like be it like between the US and Iran, like who have decided like to pressure each other on Iraqi soil and at our costs. Like we want more attention to be paid on Iraqi national problems, like be it in the realm of governance, education, service delivery, etc. And this applies like to members of all of the different sect segments of Iraqi society, the Christians, the Kurdish, the Sunni, the Shia. And this is where exactly like the governance issue and like the need for reconciliation, the need for a comprehensive reconstruction process, for a functioning reconstruction process, is like where their interests meet. And they are already like past this point of wanting like to spoil things for themselves, like for future generations, because of sectarian divisions.
Kim, do we have time for the last question we got here?
I thought to end on this beautiful note. So actually, the question will bring us into maybe a more hopeful answer too. I mean, do you think that this situation you were discussing before this happened in the pilgrimage, the reconciliation processes that you've been discussing now as well, is this something that is particular to Iraq, or do you feel that it's something that we would see elsewhere within the Islamic world?
I think we are already witnessing it all across the Islamic world, but maybe because of the historical memories that we have in our head, like we're maybe more skeptical that it would not be sustainable. And I think we should be more hopeful and more helpful for grassroots endeavors, like to see what are the issues, like where are people trying and how are people trying to come together on the ground. And then you can introduce a much more tailored facilitation assistance instead of, and I have heard this criticism by people from Iraq, but like also by people from Morocco, from Tunisia, about a lot of like this Western or like foreign designed reconciliation programs, like come to the region, like come to the local environment, listen to the issues, like see where, what is really a contentious issue. Is it really something that's sectarian? Is it an episode of history like that needs to be overcome? And then like you can co-design or like co-create something like with the local population. And this is exactly like your way of work.
We were going to ask one more thing before we finish, right, Kim? Which is, people asked us about resources, things you've written, maybe, and about maybe a fiction that you suggest that people can read about Iraq, a fiction storybook, novel, something, if anything comes to your mind.
Yes, I have. So how dark can I be?
It's your choice.
So for a fiction story, there's been an excellent novel called Frankenstein in Baghdad. I don't know how popular that is in the US, but it's from an Iraqi journalist, and I've never read something that describes the events following the US invasion, the polarization, but also like the needs for reconciliation between the different communities, the help between the different communities, as well as this novel. But as I mentioned, it's sort of a noir literature. And for things that I have written, unfortunately, my writings are rather more policy, security oriented. I'm happy to share my last reports about security sector reform and political developments in the country. And one day, like maybe after participating in a MHD tour in Iraq, I will finally get the inspiration to sit down and write my own Iraq memoirs.
Amen. Before we finish and before we say goodbye, Ina, we just want to say about next week. It's Thanksgiving, so we won't be having an episode of Crossing Boundaries. But for those of you that...
Are you going to make a turkey, Kim?
Huh?
Am I going to make a turkey?
I haven't made a turkey before, but I was in charge of making that sweet potato with marshmallows, which was shocking to me, but it was pretty good.
I did, while in Jerusalem, I would go to Bethlehem, buy fresh turkey. It's amazing. And I cooked turkey, invited all my American friends in Jerusalem. And it was fun.
Nice.
Turkey is delicious.
Aziz, maybe you can do the turkey with maluga.
Turkey. My mom would disown me if I used turkey.
Giving it a twist. Yeah, I had a Friendsgiving in New York, and it was all Israelis trying to make American dishes.
So big fail.
I mean, we liked it, so I don't know if we made it a little bit Middle Eastern.
Well, while we're not doing an episode on Thanksgiving and giving people their time with their family, we are still doing, reminding people that we're doing the cooking classes and the virtual tours that please, right. If you're interested, you can see me cooking something amazing there, which if you go to that area, we should be putting the video and you can learn how to make that dish. But I don't see it already, but we're also doing cooking classes from three different regions and tours of Israel and Palestine right now.
I think you still own one knafe.
I see, yes. I can't do knafe, but some of our people can. I'll also just say the week after next, we are talking about Cuba. And we're inviting Carmen, who is, when I went to Cuba and wanted to build our programs in Cuba, she's the person who flew with us there, introduced us to her family, and... really showed us how to run MHD tours in Cuba. Incredible, incredible person. She's obviously of Cuban descent and so lives in the States, but has big family in Cuba. And I loved my Cuba visit, not because of the Havana visit as much as it was fun, but because we went into these villages where no tourists go and just stayed with the family for a few days and got to live the life, which I think often as a tourist you don't, and having a family that you know there, it just was so much fun. So I'm looking forward to that episode.
Me too, and I will just add that we were also on podcast now. We started uploading our previous episodes, so if you missed any, and now you jog or you walk or you like to go to sleep listening to a podcast, then you can look for us. We're on different platforms, and you can search for Crossing Boundaries. And like Aziz mentioned before, if you go to our website to join a tour, you can find our virtual tours and cooking classes and more to come, right? We're thinking about different projects.
Kim is Karen is asking about the reminder of how we can donate to MHD tour guides. Well, one is booking some of these that helps the tour guides, and two, I'm sure the email we can send to people today, maybe Shannon, you can include a link to the also donation website.
There we go.
Thank you, everyone.
Have a link in the chat.
And happy Thanksgiving. Thank you, Ina. So good to see you.
So good to see you.
Bye. Bye-bye.